Hello, my name is Keith Ekus, and welcome to The Art of Translation, a podcast sponsored by the Center for the Art of Translation in conjunction with Stanford University's Arcade Project. The Center for the Art of Translation is a nonprofit based in San Francisco that promotes international literature and translation through programs in the arts, education, and community outreach. Visit us on the web at catranslation.org. The Art of Translation is an ongoing series of interviews with translators and international authors about literature and the process of carrying stories and poems between languages, where we explore the decisions that translators make as they work their way through a literary text. Noted translator Breon Mitchell joins me today to talk about his retranslation of The Tin Drum by Nobel laureate Günter Grass, the first English retranslation of The Tin Drum since Ralph Manheim's original translation 50 years ago. The new version has just appeared from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt this fall, and an excerpt from the novel appears in the latest Two Lines anthology published by the Center for the Art of Translation. Breon Mitchell is a professor of Germanic Studies and Comparative Literature and director of the Lilly Library at Indiana University and a past president of the American Literary Translators Association. He was awarded the Kurt and Helen Wolfe Prize for his translation of Uwe Timm's Marenga in 2004, and his new translation has recently been published. Joining me as well today to talk with Breon Mitchell is Olivia Sears, founder and president of the Center for the Art of Translation. Breon and Olivia, thank you for joining me. Breon, I'm particularly curious about the relationship between author and translator involved in this new translation. For starters, what is Günter Grass's relationship to this new translation and to his translators? Was it Grass who requested a new translation?
Well, first of all, Grass is directly connected to the new translation, and he's following the translations in general. He treats his translators, as he says, as his family. So it's an interesting relationship. He probably has a closer connection with his translators than any other major author that's writing today. He did request a new translation about 30 years ago. And for many years, the request didn't fall on barren ground exactly, but it was an idea that had been planted that took a while to grow and come to fruition. And what's brought it to fruition now is that it is the 50th anniversary, and it's more an idea that it's a way to celebrate Günter Grass's importance in literature and the importance of this novel by celebrating its 50th birthday in the year 2009.
Did he want the translations to come out simultaneously in all the different languages that it was going to be translated into? Was that part of the reason for the delay?
Yes, I think it is from on the part of the German publisher as well a marketing idea. The idea is why not honor a great writer and at the same time reinvigorate interest in an important novel by having several new translations come out at once. So I think it's a combination of a marketing idea on the part of the publishers and an attempt to do honor to him and the work.
When did you first meet Grass, and what was your involvement with him during this process? Is he a writer with a theoretical position on the process of translation, or was his approach more ad hoc?
I had met him two or three times at readings before, but the first close contact I had with him was in the process of doing this translation. Grass is unusual in that he asked his publishers a long time ago if he might be able to bring his translators together when he translated a new book. And so he could sit around a table and talk with all his translators at once, tell them things he thought were important about the novel, and also have them ask questions that they could all listen to and answer. This is called an Übersetzertreffen, a meeting of translators. And he did that for each new novel for the last few years, and he's done it for the retranslation here. So I gathered together with 9 other translators, so 10 different languages involved, in Gdansk, Poland, in the summer of 2005 for a week. And we met with Günter Grass and every day sat around a table like this and went through the text page by page. He doesn't have any theoretical position about translation. He's not a theorist. He's an artist. He's a craftsman. and he's interested in explaining to his translators exactly what he was trying to do, what the craft of his work was. So he would point to individual passages that he thought were interesting or perhaps difficult that he'd like us to think about. He told us what he was trying to do in many places, what his intentions were, what he would like to see preserved. And then on almost every day and almost every page, he read aloud to us from the text, and stressing the musicality and the rhythm of the text. In fact, that was the greatest impact that the meeting had on me, was just the sound of the melody of the text as he read it in my ear. And that's something you don't always see when you look at a printed page, but you hear it when it's read aloud.
Translation is usually such a solitary activity, so it must have been very interesting to be with colleagues you could discuss these issues with. I know that three other acclaimed translators from German, Michael Henry Heim, John Woods, and Krishna Winston, have translated Grass as well and are longtime friends of yours. Do you ever discuss your philosophies or swap techniques in translating Grass's work with your friends?
Well, we do from time to time. They are close friends, and we meet at least once a year in Chicago, which has become a sort of center for literary translation from the German into English at the Goethe Institute there. In the spring of each year, the Kurt and Helen Wolf Prize is awarded, and each of the people you mentioned has won that prize. Each time when we get together, the prize winner and other friends and other translators have a one-day conference and talk about the translation. So I got to hear an actual presentation by each of my friends about the work that they did when they won the award. In fact, Krishna Winston won for translating a novel called Too Far Afield by Günter Grass. So we get to hear a lot about each other and how we do things. On the other hand, it's not the case that there's a technique that one or the other of us has that can really be shared easily. We tend to talk shop more in terms of general things about the publishing world and the editorial process and so forth than we do handling any specific question. I think the only specific questions that we sometimes have talked about has been the titles of works. They're particularly problematic. The marketing and the publisher often wants a different title than the translator thinks might be the correct title. And there's disagreement always among translators as to what the best title would be. This was true with Peeling the Onion, for example, which I know Mike and the publishers went with Peeling the Onion, which I think is reasonable, but Krishna, for example, thought that the overtone of skinning the onion was important, and she would have preferred to see it be skinning the onion. And in the German, of course, to skin an onion and to peel an onion, it's the same word, and it has the word skin in it.
Right.
So
fascinating. Before you were asked to retranslate The Tin Drum, were there aspects of the first English translation that you felt needed to be updated or omissions you felt needed to be corrected, or did you discover these only after you embarked on your own translation?
My feeling about the translation, which I had taught as well as teaching the novel in German over the years as a professor, I'd also taught it in English. I thought that Ralph Manheim's translation was beautiful and very successful. And I had never compared it carefully with the German, never sat down to do it that way. When I was asked to do a new translation, I did say, well, but Ralph Manheim's translation is beautiful, so I'm not sure that I can necessarily produce anything better than that. I could produce a different translation, and I no doubt would, and I did. When I actually did the translation, the way that I did it with regard to the prior translation was to set Ralph Manheim's translation aside and do a complete translation. Then I would check each line of my translation against Ralph. And I had a copy of the work there where I kept notes. And I noted, and this wasn't an attempt to be critical, I was doing it for myself, but I noted in the copy every omission and every mistake that I found in the original. And I also noted whether or not we had agreed on the meaning of individual sentences. And his translation was extremely accurate. I found only a handful of things that I felt to be errors of understanding, misunderstandings, and those I corrected, of course, but there was very little to correct in terms of accuracy. Omissions, however, occurred on practically every page, mm-hmm. two or three a page. You have a 700-page novel. That's a lot of small things that are left out. And so those omissions and the number of omissions, I only realized afterwards when I had actually done the translation and looked back to see what had happened in Ralph's case. And once in a while, they were extremely surprising.
Was there a pattern to what was omitted?
The pattern, as far as I could see, was, and it may, and let me say that these omissions can't necessarily be laid at the door of Ralph Manheim.
Sure.
There's a lot of editorial process going on, and Helen Wolfe, who's a wonderful editor, a very important figure at the time, of course, had, I think, a very strong hand in the final text. Therefore, any single or any multiple omission that one finds is not necessarily something that Ralph Manheim even wanted to omit. They tended to be small but often significant omissions, which I think were done primarily to simplify the sentences and to make them shorter, and the thought that they were really unnecessary, particularly when the names of streets were left out. Or that's the sort of thing you think, well, why do we need to know that the apartment was on that street? Whereas my attitude was that it needed to be there, that if the author put it there, it should be there. And I made a little list of, and I'll just mention those, of some of the things that I left out, I didn't leave out, that were left out, that I restored to the English. So here's a brief list of those, because I think it gives you a feeling for the sorts of things that are left out. A pair of polished boots, a missing mustache, a lifted little finger, a disquisition on the ABCs, a head of tousled hair, some day-old pastries, a Norwegian barrel, the battered rim of a cook pot, the conservators of a bell tower, a number 5 streetcar, 4 seats at a Christmas play, an early mass, the mirror of confession, Judas, several boxes of Purcell, a daddy long legs, a Prince Heinrich memorial cap, a guitar, an apron, the churches of Reichstätt, Altstadt, Pfefferstadt, and several streets along which Oscar walked or onto which the windows of various buildings and apartments opened. That's just a handful of the sorts of things. But there are those little touches, I think, that bring a text alive as well. And so if there was a reference to the battered rim of the pot, where the battered rim had been left out, then I would reinsert that battered rim. Or if there was a cap left out, I'd put the cap back on the
character. It's a terrific list. It's like a found poem.
That's just what I was going to say.
Publish that by itself.
Exactly. Were there any passages where your interpretation disagreed with Ralph Manheim's interpretation and you felt you needed to ask the author to, as the umpire?
Not in terms of the meaning of specific passages. There were words that were either omitted, and some of those words omitted because I think at the time the translator simply couldn't know what they meant and didn't have time to ask Günter Grass about them, and I did ask. Questions went to Günter Grass through his editor, Helmut Frielinghaus, and would come through him and then come back to me. But this daddy long legs that I say is reinserted, that is a particular German word that's hard to find in the dictionary and was simply in the end omitted in the first version, and I think simply just didn't find it, didn't know what it was. It doesn't look like it's an insect necessarily, but it turns out to be a daddy long legs, and it's then sort of a nice thing to have in the text. So in those cases, I think it wasn't a case of misunderstanding so much as specialized vocabulary that he didn't have time to look up. And in the meantime, we've had 50 years of scholarship, of books that give you lists of slang and what they mean. You have the internet, you can look things up. And I have many examples of that, of those where I was able to find things that you couldn't blame Ralph Manheim for not having discovered. Also, inconsistencies, which was interesting to me, the number of steps when Oscar hurls himself down the steps, whether it's 16, 18, 19, however many, Grass was inconsistent in the German text about that. Well, and so I finally just said, let's settle on the number of steps, and we settled finally on the steps and pinned them down to one number. On the other hand, there is a situation in the novel or something that happens in the novel in which Oscar gets a certain number of packets of Lucky Strikes, and at one point there are like a dozen, and another place there are 14 or 15. And we translators said, oh, that's a different number than... And at that time, Grass said, Oscar misremembers at this point. So he did not want to change. He just said, Oscar doesn't remember there. But when it came up with regard to the steps, he didn't just say, well, Oscar's not remembering it. He's the author, and he got it. It was inconsistent, and he corrected it in that way.
What were some of the greatest linguistic challenges that you faced in this translation?
The absolute most difficult one is one that Ralph couldn't do much about, and I couldn't do much about, and no one can do much about. In fact, Mike Heim spoke at one of our gatherings in Chicago about this problem of rendering dialect in English and the ways one could go about it. Grass points out that his text in The Tin Drum is filled with dialects, and that these dialects are sometimes dialects of Danzig or the provinces around Danzig, but they may also be from Cologne or Dusseldorf, and that he said, insofar as you're able to, let's see if we can get these sharper differentiations among dialects. It shows to a certain extent that Grass is not a theoretical person. He's just an artist who hopes this can be done. Because anyone who's tried it from the other side knows that there is no good answer to dialects. It certainly doesn't answer to try to change them into a southern United States, Cockney, Brooklynese, whatever. That is generally a total failure. If you represent dialect, which I've tried to do, and which Mike Heim has done and others have done as well, you can give certain signals that let any reader know this is not standard English, this is a dialect being spoken of some sort. It has to do, obviously, with syntax and a sort of agrammatical quality. If the word ain't is in there, you know it's not an educated person. So there are little signs you can put in, this person is speaking dialect. But there is no way to differentiate between a Dusseldorf and Cologne and Danzig dialect for an English or American reader. So that was the greatest linguistic challenge. It couldn't be done. As far as I was concerned, at most what we could do is show that it's dialect. Interestingly enough, I found it interesting at any rate. I worked with the editor, Drenko Willen, at Harcourt, who's a legendary figure in her own right and a wonderful person working on this. And I really enjoyed working with her and had a good time. She, her whole approach to the dialectical portions was to tone down even what attempts I had made to make them look agrammatical and dialectical, with the argument that it didn't really show anything about dialect in particular, and it tended to put readers off a little bit because they spent all their time thinking, oh, look, he's trying to change words. And I tended to agree with that in the end because I think of the same way of an author who's just writing in English who wants to show a character that lisps, for example, or stutters. Yes, you can do it, but it gets so tiring to read it that I'm not sure it's ever very successful in an author who's writing in their own language in that way. I think Grass very successfully handles dialect in his own language, but it can't come across in particular. I asked for help from time to time from native speakers. I had a native speaker, a colleague of mine in Indiana University, who was from Cologne and knows the Cologne dialect very well, who said, well, Grass doesn't quite get this dialect right here, and it wouldn't be spelled this way, that wouldn't be. So probably some people who were specialists from their own area would also find in the original some examples where the dialect didn't quite work. That's one of the major problems. Another linguistic problem was the length of the sentences. He was very interested in the sentences being longer sentences, and actually sent a letter, and I want to just quote that letter, if I may, in which he says that he would like to have some more work done on the English version. Grass lamented, and this was in February of 78, that he, this is a quote now, the tendency of English translations to break up the structure of my necessarily long periods into easily consumed, practical, sensible sentences, and thus flatten the dramatic and temporal buildup of tension, and so destroy the effect, particularly since such longer periods are often followed by a series of short staccato sentences which depend on the gradient of what has gone before. Then he says, please don't tell me this doesn't work in English, that it runs counter to the rules. My prose doesn't follow German rules either and is an offense to standard grammars. So he wanted those long sentences. He didn't want them broken up into shorter sentences simply to make them more consumable. That's a challenge because, as we all know, to write long sentences that don't sound overly Germanic and to make them readable and make them work in English is hard. We're more used to it now because with the translations of Thomas Bernhard or Javier Marias from the Spanish, we get readers more accustomed to sentences that flow over longer periods. And a third linguistic challenge in particular, he was interested, Graz is interested in a text that reproduces the musicality and rhythm of Oscar with the tin drum. And Oscar plays this drum, sometimes a fairly regular beat, sometimes it's riffs like jazz. There's all sorts of things that are happening rhythmically in the German. And you hear that when you hear Graz read it. And he wanted us to try to reproduce this effect of a sort of musical drumming that happens, not all the time, but from time to time in various passages. That was a challenge, and because you don't want it to become just da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but you want to have some sense of musicality and rhythm. The a passage that I have here that we could look at if you wanted to.
That would be great,
is
yeah.
This, a shorter passage is one of the other things that I worked on that shows the difference between Ralph's translation and mine, but also something I think that's there in the German that's important. During the trial of a gang that's called the Dusters in Book 2 of the Tin Drum, Oscar looks down from the metaphorical heights of a diving tower and sees the world spread out before him, and he watches as the threads of current events are woven into history. This is Graz's metaphor here. So he sees all of these things happen. And the sentence that he has in German is interesting in that it describes activities in a series of 10 one-word, one-compound-word activities. I'll just read it to you. And he says, and he saw all these things were happening simultaneously below him in the world. Auch fiel mir auf, dass Tätigkeiten wie Daumen drehen, Stirn runzeln, Köpfen senken, Hände schütteln, Kinder machen, Falschgeld prägen, Licht ausknipsen, Zähne putzen, totschießen und trockenlegen, überall, wenn auch nicht gleichmäßig geschicht, geübt wurden. To me, the challenge there was to try to reproduce these 10 single word activities as compound words. Ralph Mannheim's version, and as I say, is very readable and often very beautiful, runs this way. I also saw that activities such as thumb twiddling, frowning, looking up and down, handshaking, making babies, counterfeiting, turning out the light, brushing teeth, shooting people, and changing diapers were being practiced all over the world, though not always with the same skill. Now, this is a smooth and readable sentence, and it conveys the sense of what Günter Grass's original text says quite clearly. But I think it loses what's unusual about the German. So I tried to achieve a similar rhythmic and semantic effect of the German by stretching the language a little and creating 10 English compound words, which are hyphenated here. And I saw, too, that activities like thumb twiddling, brow wrinkling, head nodding, handshaking, baby making, coin faking, light dowsing, toothbrushing, man killing, and diaper changing were being engaged in all over the world, if not always with equal skill. The sense of the sentence remains exactly the same. One version makes it perhaps a little easier on the reader being in terms of readability and not having anything unusual about it, and the other clings closer to the author. It's a little odd in some ways, but you see something's going on there. I think Ralph Manheim could have translated either way. It's a matter of philosophy of translation more than it is ability or inability to reproduce a text.
It gives it a real cadence, the way you've translated, a real kind of forward thrust. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating and wonderful to hear all three versions. I wondered if we could switch gears a little bit and talk about a previous retranslation you did of Franz Kafka's mm-hmm. The Trial. And I wondered if you might do a little compare, contrast, the difference in retranslating The Trial versus the mammoth undertaking of retranslating The Tin Drum.
Yeah. Yes, there are only two books that I've retranslated. That's The Trial and The Tin Drum. If I could have translated any book in the 20th century and had my choice to translate any, I would have chosen The Trial of Franz Kafka. The difference is, of course, that Franz Kafka is no longer with us. We have a text that is incomplete and unfinished, far different than The Tin Drum, which is a carefully finished and completed book by a living author. I revere Kafka so highly that my attempt was to follow him in everything, since I couldn't ask him whether anything could be changed, to cling even closer to the text. The retranslation also was done not to celebrate a 50th anniversary, but for reasons of copyright. The publishers, the Schocken, was running out of copyright on their translation of The Trial. This is a very important book for sales of to freshman world literature courses and so forth. They wanted to reestablish their hold on copyright. They did that by basing the new translation on a new restored version of the original German text. If you retranslate a new edited version of an original text, you get another 75 years on it. So you will not find in America any other translation of The Trial coming up that certainly not couldn't be based on that original text. So I followed that new restored text very carefully and sentence for sentence reproduced Kafka's sentences, tried to be true and faithful to his use of legal language, religious language, theatrical language, to follow his motifs extremely carefully. It was the first retranslation since the Muir's translation that had been done decades earlier. And they simply didn't have the background that we have in the meantime through scholarship and just knowing more about how things go in literature to follow through strictly all of Kafka's complex motifs and use of language, which is really quite consistent. So the bottom line is, if Kafka was inconsistent, I just left it inconsistent. I never made a change from the German. And so it's a highly, I would say, faithful in that sense, a translation that gives a good sense of an incomplete work, a work that was unfinished, that's rough in places, that is sometimes even a little odd in places. It hasn't been turned into a finished work. Gunter Grass, everything is the opposite of what I just said. We had the possibility of really knowing that a translator had a certain and was given a certain amount of freedom. Just to give one example of freedom that Gunter Grass granted us, he said that when he was sometimes would play with language, for instance, in Oscar's drumming, he brings up several phrases in German that involve the word drum in German phrases. And he said, I know that this won't be the same in all your languages, so just take drum in your language and play with it any way that you want to. So you think up something that works for you. So, for instance, in English, if we say that someone is drummed out of the Corps in military terms, right, we can use that. That's not a problem, even if that wasn't one of the phrases. And he gave us that freedom. Other times he would say things like, in a particular passage that had some complex sense to it, he'd say, the rhythm is what's important here. So if you have to sacrifice sense for rhythm, then you go for rhythm and don't worry so much about the sense, because that's what he wanted.
Lastly, I thought I'd ask you, Herta Müller recently received the Nobel Prize in Literature, and I wondered, as a scholar and translator of German literature, what was your reaction to her receiving that award?
That was interesting. I was, I must say, totally surprised, and it was totally unexpected. I received a call the morning she got the award, two calls, one from the Washington Post and one from USA Today, asking if they could quote me on my reaction to Herta Müller. By the time that call came to me, they were already looking for a story that said, nobody has ever heard of this person. So now, they found a good person in me in that sense, in that I had never read, I have never read anything by Herta Müller. So I said, Herta Müller is a closed book to me. But I said, I have two friends who have translated her work. One is Philip Beam, who was involved at least one of her books, and Michael Hoffman, who translates her. I gave them the numbers. I said, call them, ask them, they'll know all about it. About 15 minutes later, I got a call back from the woman at Washington Post, and she said, I really like your quote about that she's a closed book to you. Can I please quote you on that? And I said, under no circumstances. I said, my ignorance does not mean that she doesn't deserve the Nobel Prize. I said, I know her name well. I'm embarrassed I haven't read anything by her. It would make me sound ignorant and not mean anything except my own lack if you quote me as saying she's a closed book to me. The article came out. It starts out by saying, the Herta Müller is causing controversial reaction around the United States, and then it said, Herta Müller is a closed book to me, was one typical reaction. So that's, I don't know what, so I, okay. Then they went on, she went on to quote Harold Bloom. Harold Bloom at Yale says, I've never heard of her, and goes on. Well, of course, Harold Bloom is the man of the canon. He doesn't have to have heard of Herta Müller. But for me, I look forward to reading her work. Dennis Scheck, a friend, and was quoted at length on NPR about her, I thought, and BBC very meaningfully. I know that when Orhan Pamuk won the Nobel Prize, I had never read a line by him. I immediately started reading him. I think he's a great writer. I love him as a writer. And so for me, the Nobel Prize is a chance to open a door and to learn about writers that we should be reading and that we haven't been reading. I'm not saying that every Nobel Prize winner is necessarily the greatest writer in the world for that year, but I look forward to reading Herta Müller. I was happy that in our collection at our rare book library, because we had the papers of Norman Manya, we were able to show a first edition of Herta Müller inscribed to Norman Manya, a fellow Romanian writer. And so we always like to be able to put something out that's happening in the news.
Sure.
That's fantastic.
Well, that's terrific. It's been wonderful to have you with us here today and to hear all your insights and great stories about translating Guter Grass. Breon Mitchell, thank you for being with us today on The Art of Translation. My guest has been Breon Mitchell, the translator of most recently The Tin Drum by Guter Grass, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This has been a presentation of Arcade and the Center for the Art of Translation. Visit us on our website, catranslation.org.